Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic formula of the day is fairly straightforward. Widgets produced per hour worked. The real impact of higher worker productivity, though, isn't quite so simple. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday today, the 3rd of March. Good to have you with us. We've been talking for what seems like forever about rising worker productivity in the American economy. Companies getting more out of their employees without having to hire more people. And that trend continues today. The Labor Department said this morning productivity was up at an annual rate of more than 2.5% in the last quarter of 2010. That is a pretty fast clip. And technology does get some of the credit, but it appears the American worker has stepped up once again and become even more efficient. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more now on when, or maybe if, businesses will hit a productivity wall and have to start hiring.
So this Labor Department report confirms what many of us can feel at the office. Longer days, fewer colleagues. Mark Vittner works too hard as a senior economist at Wells Fargo.
We're producing as many goods and services today as we were prior to the recession, but we're doing it with 7.5 million fewer workers.
Let's not give productivity short shrift. Harvard economics professor Jeffrey Frankel says this report is a positive economic sign.
In the long run, there's no question whatsoever that strong productivity is what we want. It raises our standard of living, keeps cost of living down, raises our real income.
But if you've been squeezed out of a job, more productivity is not what you want to hear about. Mike Konzel with the Roosevelt Institute says there's a downside for all workers.
People are working harder at their jobs, which in theory is good, but they're not being paid anymore. So, you know, that means that there's probably a quality of life trade-off. People are spending less time with their family, their friends, their communities.
What if we forced companies to start hiring? A silent slowdown. Like, if I just decided right now, I'm not gonna finish this report. Maybe that's too unproductive. Wharton School professor Jonah Berger says a break, though, might be a chance to rethink whether work is such a virtue.
Man, I'm working really hard. I must be a good person. And it's like, really? Is that really the right measure of a person, how hard you're working? And in some sense, it's not clear that it's always better to be working harder.
Cutting out early today, in an effort, of course, to reduce high unemployment. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Doing her part, right? The United Nations released its World Food Price Index today, up more than 2% in February. And just like that productivity bump, it might not sound like a lot, but it is the biggest jump since the UN started keeping records 20 years ago. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, John Dimsdale has more.
For the most part, food prices have been on a tear since a poor summer growing season. A dry, hot summer in Russia, wet, cool weather in North America, floods in Pakistan and Australia have tightened supplies of some grains. Is this a long-term change in the weather? Nobody knows for sure, but Gawain Kripke of Oxfam takes it as a warning.
Whether or not these particular events are climate change, this is probably what the future is going to look like. More rain when you don't want it, droughts when you don't want them, and generally higher temperatures.
The Earth Policy Institute estimates each 1.8 degree rise in temperature during a growing season means a 10% loss in harvest size. Fortunately, the weather hasn't been all bad everywhere. Big rice exporters, like China, Indonesia, and Thailand, had good harvests this year. But the yields for most grains and corn and soybeans have contributed to unrest in countries that can't grow their own food, like the Middle East, says Oxfam's Kripke.
Most of the Middle Eastern countries, which are food importers, are under stress because of these high food prices, because of the balance of payments, and they have to pay more for importing food.
Protests in the Middle East are creating a price spiral for both food and oil. It takes a lot of oil to produce and transport food. As oil prices rise, so do food prices. Scarcer crops also contribute to the higher prices that create unrest in the Middle East, and all that only creates more concerns about the supply of oil, pushing the price up even more. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Forget oil and food prices and pretty much everything else and consider just that productivity report. And then you'll know what the music's going to be when we do the numbers. Best guesses are more than 150,000 people have left Libya since the violence started 2 weeks ago. Most of them are migrant workers from other countries in North Africa. Tens of thousands of people, though, are still stranded in camps on the Libyan border. President Obama said today that U.S. transport planes would be on their way tomorrow to help get them home. Several European countries, including Britain and France, are already doing that. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the European desk in London, it's not all out of the goodness of their hearts.
Britain got most of its own nationals away from Libya last week. Now the UK wants to help other, less well-off countries evacuate their citizens, as Prime Minister David Cameron told Parliament.
Today we're launching a UK operation to airlift several thousand people back to Egypt from the Libyan-Tunisian border. I think it's vital to do this. These people shouldn't be kept in transit camps if it's possible to take them back to their home.
The French and the Spanish are helping with the effort. The Europeans are trying to prevent thousands of refugees heading their way, something Spain certainly wants to avoid, says Gail Allard of the IE Business School in Madrid.
There's great concern about an influx of people that the economy is simply not prepared to handle, with the unemployment rates where they are at 20.3% on the last survey.
The Italians are worried too. They fear an influx of 300,000 North Africans. Philip White is with the Centre for European Reform.
There is a growing concern amongst a lot of Western European countries about the number of people coming to Europe, particularly given the economic backdrop, which is, of course, pretty awful.
Spain has called for a big international programme of financial support for Arab countries to persuade their citizens to stay put. But with the governments of the US and Europe strapped for cash, that call seems likely to fall on deaf ears. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's not all that big a secret that foreign countries hire Washington lobbyists. In fact, it's not a secret at all. Lobbyists dispense political advice. They help deliver friendly legislation. A lot of countries, though, also hire PR firms to develop ad campaigns that encourage investment and boost tourism, to spin some good stories about what goes on there, even if what goes on there isn't always all that good. Last year, a small country in North Africa needed some help. So Tunisia turned to the Washington Media Group. From Washington Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
So here I am in a sunny penthouse suite above the International Spy Museum. These are the offices of the Washington Media Group. Last year, the small PR firm inked a deal with Tunisia, a magnet for European beachgoers. Greg Vistica runs the shop.
They had a high profile, obviously, in Europe, particularly France and Great Britain, but in the United States, it was, very, very, very low.
Vistica and his team of former reporters and political insiders thought Tunisia had a good story to tell.
You know, they wanted foreign direct investment in the country. They wanted tourism in the country. And they wanted people to be aware of their story.
Vistica says Tunisia was an American ally and appeared moderate and open to doing business. So the firm started to gin up buzz about the country. They put together what Vistica calls a story bank.
It's a bank of good potential stories, leads, tips, anecdotes, whatever, that we can shape stories around. And we get those all done, and then at the appropriate time, we can start laying those out for reporters and for the press.
Vistica was a producer for CBS News and an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Today, he's a PR man, not a lobbyist, he tells me. Vistica says he doesn't try to influence Congress directly, so he's not registered. But as he describes what he does, from survey research to print and TV ad campaigns, I remember something James Thurber told me. He's a public policy professor at American University.
I think that there are many more people in Washington, D.C. that are in the advocacy business than are registered.
As many as 100,000 people, he says, and lots of them work for countries around the world. But even a former investigative reporter can do tons of due diligence and end up not knowing exactly what his firm is dealing with. I asked Vistica if he was reluctant to take on Tunisia. After all, my own quick web search turned up allegations of corruption and human rights violations.
We had suspicions that there were issues with Tunisia. I mean, every country has, you know, has issues.
And those issues soon became very public. Last fall, WikiLeaks released hundreds of thousands of diplomatic cables. Some detailed how then-President Ben Ali spent wildly on mansions and yachts, how his family seized one of the country's biggest banks.
It confirmed for us suspicions that we had about the government and about particularly the first family.
At tense meetings, the Washington Media Group talked over their game plan. Vistica turned to contacts around the world as the protests kept growing. Then, Ben Ali began losing his grip on power, and government forces started shooting unarmed civilians.
We just decided we couldn't be a part of a government or support or work for a government that was doing that. So that, for us, was the final straw.
The firm decided it couldn't salvage Tunisia's reputation, but it had to protect its own. The Washington Media Group broke its nearly $500,000 contract on January 6th. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
If you're curious how one goes about firing a foreign country, you can read the termination letter that Greg Vistica sent. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, treating Russian alcoholics with a little pill.
Because it is placed in a person's body and kept the way a torpedo in a submarine is kept.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hey, can you hear me over the happy music? The Dow Industrial jumped 1.5% today, 191 points closed at 12,258. The best one-day gain for the Dow since December the 1st. The Nasdaq muscled up 1.8%, 50 points, 2798 at the close. The S&P 500 shot up 1.7%, 22 points, ended things at 1330. February turned out to be a sweet month for some retailers. Saks bounced nearly 4% today on better-than-expected monthly sales. Macy's put on 0.25%. Nordstrom tacked on nearly 1%. No Valentine's, though, for JCPenney. Its shares fell more than 0.75% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at AllyBank.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Are things getting any better out there for job seekers? The Labor Department releases unemployment data for February. The International Festival of Owls gets underway in Houston, Minnesota. Who attends? Kids and adults, and of course, some owls. And it's time to police your punctuation. Tomorrow is National Grammar Day. Who am I? Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The photographer J. Henry Fair does landscapes, images of places that have been changed somehow by the industrial process. Places like the Gulf of Mexico and the BP oil spill, or clear-cut forests and pulp mills. They're aerial shots of what is actually quite picturesque terrain.
You're sticking your head out the window in basically a 70-mile-an-hour wind, and you're shooting with a long telephoto lens. So you pretty much have to go on autopilot.
The pictures are collected in a new book called The Day After Tomorrow, Images of Our Earth in Crisis. They're up on our website right now if you want to have a look, marketplace.org. And we've got Henry Fair here for our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy. Henry, good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kai.
I wanted to start with one of the pictures from this book that I found most striking. It's a series of overhead shot, aerial shot, of some emerald green, really stunning water with kind of white fringes around them, white mounds of stuff surrounded by some pipes. What are those?
That's exactly the question I asked when I found it. And it's not water, and the whiteness, it looks like snow from above. It turns out to be gypsum, which is part of the process waste from the manufacturing of phosphate fertilizer. But, of course, I'm going backwards because when I photographed that, I had no idea what it was. So then it became a process of figuring it out.
What'd you do? You must have gotten out of the plane and driven around, right?
I had to go back down. So that's on the Mississippi River south of Baton Rouge. And after I had taken the picture and couldn't figure out what it was and asked a bunch of engineers and whatnot, I went back down there and rented a car and drove up. And I'm from the South, so in my best Southern accent, I said, "Excuse me, can I use your bathroom? And what do y'all make here?"
Wow.
And by the time I drove up, I knew what the answer to the question was. And the guard there wouldn't let me go to the top of the mound, but she did let me use the bathroom.
It's all part of this area you found, this region, I suppose, in Mississippi that you call Cancer Alley, right?
It happens to be, when I started doing this project, it was before Google Earth, et cetera. So I needed a place where I knew there would be industry that would make photogenic images. Originally, I was mostly into making these beautiful images to make people think, but I quickly found out that I had to have the data behind it before the images could really be effective.
Yeah, it was an investigative process, right?
Yeah. Those green pictures are the process waste from the making of phosphate fertilizer, and they are both radioactive and very acidic. So what we have is we have a phosphate crisis that dwarfs the gas crisis, and we're going to run out in 40 years, and then we're not going to be able to feed ourselves.
You are fairly explicit, though, in your aims for this book. You say right out it's a book about the power that a consumer has to shape the world through the purchase decisions that they make.
Yes. And the reason that these pictures are so effective is because they're both horrible and beautiful. And by stimulating curiosity, we can hopefully get people to ask questions. And when they get the answers, consider the consequences of a given purchase. When I speak to school children, I only exaggerate slightly when I tell them that the most important decision that they can make is which toilet paper to buy. And that seems laughable, but one toilet paper promotes deforestation of old-growth forests, and another toilet paper promotes the recycling chain that we really want to promote.
These pictures are about the environment, obviously. They're about human behavior. They are fundamentally, though, about the commercial process, about money.
Everything is.
J. Henry Fair, his new book of photographs is called The Day After Tomorrow, Images of Our Earth in Crisis. You can see some images from it. It's at our book blog. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai. It's an honor to be here.
Alcoholism and Russia have a long and destructive history together. Alcohol abuse costs that country 500,000 deaths a year, most of them men of working age. It also costs billions of dollars in lost productivity. Male life expectancy in Russia is just 60 years, and the Russian population is predicted to shrink nearly 20% by the middle of the century, in part because of the drinking. Every problem, though, creates a market for a cure. In this case, a big market. Our healthcare correspondent Gregory Warner went to Moscow to track down one very popular cure and the doctors who sell it.
For me, this all started with a story I heard about a friend's ex-boyfriend, a Russian alcoholic who promised he'd never, ever drink again. Story was he got a capsule surgically inserted under his skin, some kind of chemical compound such that if he drank, that capsule would explode into his bloodstream and kill him. When I got to Moscow, I found out there are dozens of clinics that do this procedure. I visit one of them with my translator, Anna Mastarova.
So is this the waiting room?
So it's a private clinic.
It's a nice place. There's a fish tank in the waiting room, lush carpet, and a list of treatments on the wall.
They have all kinds of massage, like craft therapies.
And then we're summoned to the office of the head doctor, Vyacheslav Davidov.
Vyacheslav?
He's got a pinstripe suit and bright, bright green eyes.
Но обычно вшивается в мягкие.
So usually this capsule is inserted into the buttocks.
That is under the skin of your buttocks.
Поэтому и назвали торпеда.
Actually, that's why it was called a torpedo, because it is placed in a person's body and kept the way a torpedo in a submarine is kept.
And then, if you have a drink, watch out.
One can never exclude death, but of course the doctor is not going to kill his patient. But the person will feel very bad, extremely bad. You will have pains, almost unbearable pains.
Живот болит, голова болит, сердце болит.
Accelerated heart rate,
everything.
Shortness of breath,
stomach,
nausea, vomiting, throbbing headache, visual disturbance, mental confusion, and circulatory collapse.
And these medicine can remain in the body from a short period of time to like 3 years, for instance.
Is the capsule in some way a placebo?
А плацебо? Нет, это не плацебо.
Нет, it's not a placebo.
Если не верите, могу дать таблеточку.
If you don't believe, I can give you a pill for 1 day.
Okay.
И выпьешь.
I said I'd take the pill.
Can you give me a pill that would last 3 years?
Если вы согласитесь.
If you agree.
Here's why I agreed. I couldn't leave Davidov's office without seeing the capsule and figuring out what's in it. But the whole time we'd been in his office, he wouldn't show me the pill or any of the clinic. The only way I was going to be able to see this supposed medicine was to agree to take it.
You'll be patient. You'll be a patient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
So we leave his office, head upstairs, down this long hallway. There's a sound of screaming. He leads me into the procedure room.
Oh, is it?
Just like an exam room in a doctor's office. Got the white furniture, the sterile instruments, except against one wall is this old green leather chair with thick straps that go on your arms and your legs. And he tells me he's going to strap me into that chair, give me a pill with the same medicine that's in the torpedo, and then he'll test it.
So you take a pill and he'll give you a drop of alcohol.
Yeah, provocation.
This is called a provocation because he puts just a drop of vodka on my
small
tongue.
Small drop of alcohol.
Once that drop of vodka hits my tongue, I will feel all those symptoms. Next to the chair, I see the defibrillator.
In case when we do provocation, something happens in order to be able to.
Like if their heart stops?
Ну, если сердце остановится, да?
Да, да, на всякий случай.
Just in case.
Maybe can I take it at home?
So I
actually no, I don't want to take it.
Chickened out.
I can't do it. I'm not strong enough.
He at that point realized he had won.
What is the tablet?
And he shows me the pill at this point.
This is what is inserted in the body.
Really? This is it? It's so
little.
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 So it turns out that inside that little pill is a very real drug. It's called disulfiram.
And it was actually a substance that was used in the rubber industry.
Eugene Rakel is an assistant professor at the University of Chicago.
And they found that the workers in the rubber industry were unable to tolerate alcohol.
Disulfiram blocks a certain enzyme from being absorbed by the liver. So when you drink, it causes all these very real symptoms. But it's only in Russia that they sell these very long-acting capsules.
Basically, they tell you that they're injecting a long-acting form of disulfiram, which is not something that exists.
It does not last 3 years. In fact, it barely lasts a week. But
this is not fringy at all.
He says that up to 80% of addiction treatments by Russian doctors are procedures like this torpedo.
Yeah.
Meaning this is more popular than Alcoholics Anonymous and every other kind of treatment combined. Even my interpreter, Anna, her uncle was an alcoholic.
He could go fishing and then disappear for a night and nobody knew where he was. I mean, everybody knew that he was drunk.
Then he got a procedure like the torpedo.
Yeah, I don't know how it worked, but it did work for him because he hadn't drunk till the rest of his life.
Rachel says that if it worked, it's partly because Russians understand addiction differently.
I think that here's the distinction. You know, in North America, the prevailing understanding of addiction, it's not about the substance as much as it is about the fact that you're kind of out of touch with some kind of truths about your self and your condition.
Whereas in Russia, he says,
many of the patients I talk to say, I don't actually have to change myself in any way. I don't have to become a different person.
I just have to get rid of my addiction, which is what Dr. Davidoff offers. When he gives you that pill and he puts that drop of vodka on your tongue, he scares that part of you into submission.
And what rules this world?
Strach.
Fear.
For this service, he charges 5,000 rubles, $170. And if, a few weeks later, you ignore his warning and you do take a drink and nothing happens, well, then you call up Dr. Davidoff and he'll tell you that
идет реакция, но она идет замедленная.
It's like a delayed reaction.
That torpedo poison is loose in your bloodstream. Could cause a heart attack or cancer, and you need to purchase the antidote.
And how much is the antidote?
8,000 rubles.
8,000 rubles, about $300.
Хочешь выпить, плати.
If you want a drink, you have to pay.
In Moscow, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Gregory's story was a collaboration with Radiolab, which is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today negotiations between NFL team owners and the Players Association continue. Their deadline has been extended through tomorrow. But President Obama was asked at a press conference today what he thinks about the prospects of a lockout in the National Football League. Doesn't think much, apparently said he doesn't have a lot of sympathy for billionaires and millionaires arguing over money. And oh, by the way, don't look for him to get involved.
My expectation and hope is that they will resolve it without me intervening because it turns out I've got a lot of other stuff to do.
Yeah, don't we all? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow jumped 1.5%, 191 points. The Nasdaq spiked 1.8%, 50 points. The S&P 500 shot up 1.75%, about 22 points. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and then where?
This awakening made the young men and women in Saudi Arabia fearless.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.